So I'm pleased to introduce the first speaker, Professor Amir Hamedi from Hebrew University of Jerusalem. So Amir has been working in Jerusalem, in Boston, on a very important aspect of plasticity in the visual system, but more importantly, how both the hearing and the visual system can work together and compensate each other, leading to an integration and the possibility to compensate by each other. So it's very scenic, but it's also very important for the future of visual rehabilitation. And I'm very pleased to pass on the word to Amir, who is also a good friend.
Okay, so it's a pleasure to be here. The title of the talk is talking about plasticity in the human brain, lessons from longitudinal multisensory studies. In case I don't make it to the end, I want to give the credit for the main people I'm going to present their work. Several master and PhD students in the lab, Shachar Mandenbaum, Sami Aboud, Elas Traim Amit, and Lior Reich, and some work of Roni Arbel. Some work in collaboration with Jose towards the end, and some work together with Stanislas Dihan and Laurent Cohen. I was asked to make a very quick introduction about the cortical processing of visual input, which is a very dangerous mission to do in front of people like Brian Wandel, but I will try to do it for 2-3 minutes. So basically we have input coming from our eyes. Like in all the senses, we have a transduction, converting some physical part of the world into electric signals. It travels into the thalamus and then arrives to the cortex to a series of steps. The first station is this V1, V2, and the rest of the retinotopic areas, which preserve some mapping of the external topography inside the topographical map inside our brain. And it starts with analyzing very simple features like line junctions and lines and so on and so forth. And then we have basically two main streams of processing. One, the watt stream, in which we analyze and understand what is the shape and what is the color of things in front of us. And then we have the dorsal stream. Both starts already from the retinotopic areas and go to non-retinotopic or high-order areas, which basically this where or how stream gives us information about the location of objects in the preparation of acting upon them. Okay, and we have different reference frame there. And then we have several areas, high-order areas. I'm not going to mention all of them, but just several ones, which show additional specialization or cortical specialization or the peak activity for a given category or selectivity is for these objects. One is this LOC area, the human homologue of IT cortex, in which represents objects and tools found by in human by Rafi Malach. Then we have areas which are actually quite surprising and found by Laurent Cohen and Stanislas Dihan, built also on some neurological condition in which you can lose specifically the ability to read without losing your ability to see, for example, objects or to recognize them. And it's a very consistent area, and there is a set of very interesting questions about this area, and recently it was found by Joseph Parvizi that there is a homologue in the right hemisphere, so this in the left hemisphere, that is selective more to symbols, not of phonemes, but symbols that represent quantity or numbers, in other words. We have faces in various areas, selectivity for scenes and houses and so on and so forth, and also more recently it was found that there is selectivity to our body. Besides the head, a representation of visual representation of our body image. So this is a two minutes overview of the cortical processing of visual input, and there is some open question I would like to pose here in this context of cortical processing and of visual and auditory processing. So the open questions are the following. One question is, what is the origins of all these selectivities as I mentioned here in the visual system, both in high order and retinotopic areas? One type of set of question is the famous nature versus nurture debate, which we apply here for the question of selectivity and development of these pathways, of these selectivities in the visual system. The second question is, what is the role of visual input and visual experience to shape up all these specializations? This is the second set of questions. And of course, we are going to ask, is there a critical period in the sense that is there a point of time that we must have of exposure to visual stimuli in order to develop all these selectivities? Third set of questions, not all, some of the questions overlap to some extent, is to ask what is the evolutionary timescales for specializations. So, for example, we have some categories like faces or like tools in which we had enough time in evolution for natural selection to operate and create this type of selectivities. On the other end, when we talk about the highly consistent activity in different languages and in different people for reading or for these numerical representations, then we are talking about things that are less than 10,000 years, all of them, so we don't have enough time for natural selection. So how do we have such a consistency across people with this type of selectivity? And finally, I'm going to ask whether these areas are visual at all. All this 30% of the brain or whatever, there is different estimates, is it really visual in essence, or visual is the most compatible sense to work with this cortex? How much vision have a critical role in shaping out functional specialization and the functional connectivity and anatomical connectivity in the visual system? So this is basically what I'm going to ask in this 30, 40 minutes of this talk. And since we are already in the morning, maybe you would like to sleep a little bit more until the next talk. So I will already give you the bottom line of the talk, of this talk, and I will try to convince you with some data, and it will be more an overview, so I won't take one study and get very deep into it, but try to do some overview of the recent couple of years of studies in our lab and in several other labs, and I will try to suggest that all the specializations, including retinotopic biases, can emerge to some extent without any visual experience. They can also emerge in people that had visual experience but learned to use and perform the same task in a different sensory modality. And this might teach us about the origins of specializations. So I will return to this summary slide in the end, but basically the bottom line is that the visual cortex principles of functional specialization and organization can develop without visual experience. So it's a pretty bold argument, so we'll see if we have enough data to support it. This can also occur in the normally developed brain to non-visual input in terms of hours or tens of hours, but only if the right cross-modal correspondence between the senses are learned. If we create a situation in which the other sensory modality gives you very similar information to what is given in by vision originally, and we suggest that this novel task-specific sensory-independent organization and plasticity is driven by a combination of connectivity biases, that some of them might be innate, and sensitivity to task-distinctive features for each area or network within the visual system. We will actually generalize it also to the auditory system, but probably won't have time in this talk. So this will be the various studies. So how can we check this type of question? What was the model that we chose to in some of the studies that we took? So one approach was to look on all the spectrum from people that had normal vision via all various types of visual deprivation. It can be a partial visual deprivation, but we have a couple of new studies on this together with the Institut de la Vision and Joseph Elwood, but I won't present them today. And all the way to presenting, and this is what I will focus today, in testing people that didn't have visual experience. They were born blind, or they are even micro-ophthalmic, or never had their retina developed. Okay? And using various imaging methods for the average population activity, functional and anatomical connectivity, we can basically look at how the brain respond. And the last part of this model is to combine it with the field of sensory substitution device. So what is a sensory substitution device? We suggest it's a very, very interesting model to study these questions, because sensory substitution devices that were suggested originally by Paul Bacharita, in which we recently wrote a neuroscience and biobehavioral review, a whole issue dedicated to a work inspired by his ideas of sensory substitution. And the idea in sensory substitution that you basically try to take information that's coming from one sense and embed some of it using some type of algorithms in a different sensory modality, okay? And the idea is that we see not only with our eyes, there is a whole interplay between the input that comes to our eyes and the processing that is done in the brain that gives us a rise to visual experience. So basically what Paul Bacharita said, let's make a bypass. We'll take the visual input, we will embed it. We mainly use tactile sensory substitution. We will embed this information in touch, and then the brain will do the reverse mapping, okay? So it will get this tactile stimulation, let's say on the tongue or on a different parts of the body, and he will understand what was the input image coming from the camera, okay? So this is really attractive because in a way we are having a topographic representation, and I would try to show you that you can even try and represent color and the color of different objects, their identity, their location in space. So we are preserving a lot of what vision is all about, but now doing it in a different sensory modality, okay? So we can ask all the set of questions that I was posing here. So I will give you an example of a very simple, minimalistic. So also sensory substitution can come in different flavors. You can either have a minimalistic sensory substitution, a device that replaces only one of the aspects. So for example, Braille is a very famous example of sensory substitution, but it takes only one aspect from the entire visual world. It just takes characters and converts it into touch. This is a sensory substitution, a minimalistic sensory substitution we developed in the lab called the iCane. And basically, it gives you information about only distance to obstacles up to 5 meters from you in one or in several directions. And what I want to show you that when you take one component, it can be very intuitive. So in this case, I'm going to show you a movie about a congenitally blind that had 2 minutes of experience with this device that transformed distance into vibrations. And basically, the mission is to go out of a maze, okay? So you can see here the congenitally blind. We have the student, in this case, Daniel Ober-Chabat, who was going after him, and you see that he's looking away. This is actually twice the real speed, okay? But it's pretty cool. He can get a grasp of their spatial organization of the environment to some extent and go out. And what is neat about this setup is that you can actually create a similar, so we created this array of big Hebb-Williams mazes, and you can create the same environment in the scanner, in virtual environment. So basically what you see here is a study that we conduct now on navigation using the various sensors that Shachar Mandelbaum is leading. You can see here that sighted, even without zero training, go in, and of course they can manage to find a way out and do it very efficiently. And you can see here when they get this cane and navigate inside a virtual environment that replicates these different mazes, in their first encounter, they are stuck in the area of the starting point. So this is a heat map of where they spent inside the maze, inside the scanner, when we scan them, when they didn't have knowledge how to use this a cane. And then after they learned this specific maze, you can see that they found a way out. And you can see here, for example, so we did it again on blindfolded, sighted before and after learning, congenitally blind, so without visual experience, and sighted. And you can see here some initial results, pilot results from this study, which shows very nice selectivity, actually recruitment of the parietal cortex, But in addition to it, actually the peak of activation was in dorsal retinotopic areas. Peripheral dorsal retinotopic areas. There was actually deactivation of the hippocampus. And what is really cool is that we also found some activation that overlapped with some, recently we took the classic retinotopic methods that were developed by Engel and by Brian Rondell and Marty Serino, and basically applied the same phase locking approaches to map the body representation. And you can see here very beautifully that, so some of the homunculi, like pencil homunculi, we have a very good idea what they do. And some, there is a nice correspondence with the animal studies, like this putamen homunculi, and some homunculi were completely new. And basically what you see here is that there is a very nice overlap between the navigation system and this body representation, and actually there is a selectivity to the middle and lower part of the body. So this is type of, and you can see a very nice selectivity when they navigate in a real maze versus scrambled maze. So this is the type of work you can start doing with sensory substitution devices. But this is these minimalistic devices that only preserve one feature. What I'm going to do in the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus on the auditory modality and on more holistic topographic sensory substitution that try to maintain information in the entire image. Okay, so to get all these aspects of shape, color, and location. Of course, in worse resolution, of course, it's difficult to learn it, it's much more cognitively demanding, and so on and so forth. And we choose the auditory modality because we thought it's, first of all, in principle, if you choose temporal algorithm, you can actually create much more resolution, because here in the touch case, you're limited by the just noticeable difference by the 2-point discrimination. So for example, in the back, it's about 4 centimeters. So if you cover the entire back, you are limited with the number. So actually here you can get to thousands and even tens of thousands of pixels in principle. And also what was really important to us is that it's super cheap. You don't need to create all this very expensive arrays of touch. And the last component, it's very easy to do an imaging experiments with it, because it's basically you need to give auditory stimulation. Okay, so we thought this is a better setup to ask this question that I posed in the beginning. So how do this, I'm going to present to you data from mainly from the iMusic algorithm that we developed. It have two versions. One is a grayscale version, and the second is using exactly the same principles, but now with the color, adding color information. But let's start with this simple example. So if we had this letter V, yeah, and I want to decode it in touch, so I will stimulate these electrodes, okay? Now, what about if I want to do it in the auditory modality? So the idea is that we are going to have notes in a pentatonic scale. One white pentatonic scale, there is a beautiful TED talk by Bobby McFerrin with some very nice demos showing how pentatonic scales are universal. It's a 5 minutes but beautiful talk that show what's the power of this type of scale. So if I'm going to hit high notes, I'm going to hear more soprano, and if the pixels are lower, it will be low, and if it will be lower, then it will be the basses, okay, the bass sound. So basically, we scan the image from left to right, and the brain, the subject, need to learn to do an integral over time. It starts with every 3 seconds, so it's a very slow motion vision, very, very slow motion, but the best subjects can get into 1 second and even half a second of refresh rate, but usually they say within this range of one. Now, it's a more scientific question talk, so I'm not going to do a lot of demos, but usually I can show you that after 5 minutes of training, I can already put you a word that you are not able to see. You are just hearing these musical sounds going in different directions, and about half of the audience managed to write down the word. So it's very intuitive. By the way, it's very different from Braille in this sense, in which late blind found it extremely difficult to learn. Okay, and there is a big percentage that actually never managed to learn it. And also we compare it, we will compare it in the end to visual prosthesis. This is also something that takes much more time and much more effort in visual prosthesis. So there is something about this type of topographic representation and these temporal changes that is very relatively intuitive. Of course, you need to devote a lot of effort to learn it, and I will show it in a minute. Recently, we also developed a Bluetooth glove on the both hands, and the idea is that you can scan at the same time the you get the sounds or the touch. It can fit different type of blindness. It can help you to teach without. Right now, we are very limited because somebody needs to teach them. So we now develop some games. We develop this tactile glove that you can learn from your own tactile experience, which is more topographic in its nature, and so on and so forth. But I'm going to focus on this. This is a representation. This is another example. So just let's do a 1 minute of... I won't teach you to read the whole word. I don't want to waste the time, but let's do a couple of letters. So I showed you the sounds of the diagonal. If I want the letter V, how would this sound? You can, yeah, draw me in the hand. It's going down and then up, right? And then, so the scale going down, scale going up. How about W? Okay, and M, it will be the opposite, and so on and so forth. Okay, L will be a very brief sound that includes a lot of sounds, very brief, and then the low bass, and so on and so forth. Okay, so now how about adding colors? So the adding colors is actually pretty simple. The idea was to make some clustering into one of the main five colors. Red, green, blue, and yellow, and whitish with all their brightness level. And we simply replace, if the pixel is white or grayscale, we keep this human singing, yeah? And we also know that we have areas dedicated to analyzing voices of humans and special specialization, not only to faces, but also to voices, shown by Pascal Benlan. So this is why we choose it for the basic algorithm. But if you have, for example, your hand, here on the piano, so you can see the resolution, the original image. This is the resolution of the iMusic. So this keyboard will have a lowering, descending sound with some spectrum. And suddenly we hear the piano in a very low tones. And you would, if you are enough experienced, you can understand that this is your hand. And this is actually really nice, separating your body from the environment and interacting with it. If you have some signal that gives you in a different musical instrument, the body, we'll talk later about this. So what do the blind can do with this? They can learn to read the text, the numbers, of course, much slower than vision. Everything is slower than vision. Object and object recognition, body images, numeral symbols, faces, and even faces and facial expression. I will show you only one very short movie. Again, I don't want to waste time on the technology. I want to get into the imaging and to the plasticity studies. But basically, they can pick up any of these bottles quite quickly or in the supermarket. They can look at the clouds for the first time or the first time in many years and recognize pattern or the moon or things like this. This is things they really enjoy doing. But they can also, after about 40 hours of training, learn to recognize facial expressions and even the identity of famous people like Marilyn Monroe, which in some lower resolution you can still record. So let's do a very quick movie about this. This is Chamutal. Just a second, just to show you the setup. This is Chamutal, congenitally blind. You see here the camera. And this is Ella, which was leading the neuroimaging, this neuroimaging study results that I'm going to show you soon. And now the generalization to a new person, and so this is the basically one example. Okay, this was actually done with the voice SSD of Peter Mayer, which is not including color for the face identification. We use the iMusic with all the color features and the color hair and so on and so forth. I won't get too much. I just want to mention, so they can do a lot of really cool things that you will see, but I just want to have like an over-optimism warning. I think SSDs are a very useful tool and great for basic research, but currently they are not a valid replacement for vision as a standalone. There is some gaps. I want to say that we work on all these gaps and we start filling these gaps. But there are different issues like cognitive load, decency training, and so on and so forth. There is also no direct visual experience, although some developed that actually there is very interesting phenomena that we now study, in which you initially, for example, with the glove or with the sound, feel the object that you are looking at coming from your body or from your ears, and then you have a phenomena which called distal attribution, in which you stop perceiving the sensory input coming from your body or from your ears, but you start experiencing from the outside world. So it starts to be having these abilities of vision to be a far sensing. Usually most of our senses, a little bit audition, but mostly vision is our far sensing sense. So this distal attribution is when you start understanding that the information come not from touch or from sound on nobody, but from the outside world. And then some subject, but this is still under debate and under investigation, starts, especially late blind, start to develop visual hallucinations when they interact with objects. So they would close the door and the door would jump to them and so on and so forth. So there might be also some beginning of visual experience, which is very interesting. There might be some ways, pharmacological or electrical, to boost these experiences, but this is a really open question. On the other end, with visual prosthesis, the second you do the operation, even in the operation, you turn on the electrode, immediately you have visual experience. I will get back to this point maybe in the end of the talk, but now I want to go back to this open question. What happened in the brain when blind or sighted learned to recognize objects or use these various categories of specialization using SSDs, and what is the role of visual input and visual experience in shaping up this specialization? But before that, I want to show you a little movie about the chronometry, the neurochronometry of processing objects, reading a word, recognizing a face, recognizing a bottle when they are inside the scanner. And basically what we did in the study, and what is nice here is that it's really quite replicable across individuals. So I would present you a movie coming from a congenitally blind. And what you see here is the classical division of labor that we have, this notion of visual cortex, of auditory cortex. So in red, we have this auditory visual system, ventral stream, dorsal stream. Then in the blue, we have all these areas that process music, sound, language, and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is basically the sensory, just looking at the brain as a sensory machine. We have different channels, they go to different cortical areas, and this is how they're processed. Now, this image is going to turn into a movie, but basically what we did in this type of studies is that we took these classical methods which used for retinotopy mapping, in which you organize the world according to a given principle of organization. So for example, in retinotopy, Brian Mundell and others showed very beautifully. So if you organize the stimuli coming from the fovea to the periphery, you get a whole map that represents center to periphery. And the way you do it is you repeat it in a given frequency many, many times. And then you can do various analyses. For example, you can do a Fourier analysis, look at the frequency of... you can see here that there is a lot of power in the frequency of stimulation. And then... very low power for the rest. And then you can add into these high power voxels the phase information, okay? So this is how we use to replicate the Penfold homunculus and find this homuncula in the cerebellum and insula and some other places, okay? But now we apply that for sensory substitution, because actually sensory substitution object recognition is slow motion. Usually it's very fast. We finish to recognize an object in less than one TR, in one time that we covered an entire brain. So there is no point in fMRI to look at timing, okay? But actually here in this case, it takes them about 4-5 seconds to create the mental representation, this topographic mental representation in the brain coming from the sound. So actually you can have, If you use TR1, you can have 4 or 5 points. And now you repeat it over and over again in a given frequency. So you get, and we focused here only on the auditory and visual system. And what you see here very nicely is that both the blue areas and the red areas are lighting up. So this is already telling us that actually, at least in the case of developing without visual experience, but I will show you the same happens in the sighted, both the auditory system and the visual system works in coordination. But actually the picture is even more interesting because what blue and red represent here is early in the processing and later in the processing. Okay, so the early TRs and the later TRs. And what's going on is that initially the sound or the interpretation of this image or in movie in a second is that when we start to listening to the sound, let's say I'm giving you the letter W, and I didn't tell you this is a W, you're just listening to it, or let's do how do they do this, the facial expression. If it's a smiley face, it will go, the rest of the face would stay the same, and then we have a line going, a sound going down and then up. If it's a sad face, it goes up and down. If it's indifferent, it's like this. If it's a surprise face like you saw in the movie, you will have one melody going up and the other down. Or basically, you will have a sad face and a smiling face at the same time. Okay, so you have two. Okay, so if you understand, it's difficult. Okay, it takes time. This is why you need these 40 hours to get into facial expression. So what do we see in this movie? We see that actually, what is going on is that it seems like that the brain is doing the reverse engineering of what we did with the sensory substitution. We took a colored image and embedded this information, topography, location, and so on and so forth, inside the sounds. Now the sounds go to the auditory system, A1, S-L gyrus areas around it, maybe doing some quick Fourier analysis, so this is just speculation of the frequencies and the amplitude. But when we start to build the image, and in the time that we recognize that this is the word heel, or this is a face, or this is a bottle, then most of the activation is actually recruiting the most of the visual system, and mainly the ventral stream, but also of the ventral stream, and go all the way to V1. Okay, so it seems like that the brain is already telling us that is using both the auditory and the visual system, but what is most interesting here in this movie is that actually the buildup of the topography in the brain of people that never experience visual experience or never had the retina is done exactly in the same place that we are doing this type of topography and color and so on and so forth. So this is result number one. Now, the second thing we moved on is to look at this what-where organization. So basically, what we did here was super simple. We took the classic experiment of Leslie Ungeleider and Mortimer Mishkin in NIH, in which basically they give the same pairs of stimuli, but one time, you have two different tasks. Okay, so now we start to introduce the concept of task and specialization. And what was shown in this classical experiment is that when you are performing a shape judgment about these pairs, they can be in the same shape or different shape, different same location, different location. So when you ignore the location and focus on the shape, you get recruitment of the ventral stream, and the vice versa if you do localization. So basically, we did exactly the same. And what you see here is the selectivity for... what I want to emphasize is that the physical stimulation in terms of the auditory input in this case, or the visual input in case of the Ungeleider and Mishkin experiment, is exactly the same. It's just the computation that you do on it. What is the judgment? What is the task? What is the computation you requested to do? And what we show is that both in sighted and congenitally blind, there is an overlap in ITS and in the precuneus. In the case of the ventral streams, actually go more posterior. In the dorsal stream, it stays in high order areas. But there is in the peak of overlap, there is actually the same selectivity, both in blind, congenitally blind, without visual experience, and sighted, of selectivity to shape versus location in ITS, and the vice versa in the precuneus and the dorsal stream. A similar experiment was done by the Alfonso Karamassad group, showing that the animate in animate, there is some organization for animate in animate. There is a lot of debate of what is the source of it and so on and so on, but basically can be replicated also in congenitally blind. So far we talked about the general processing of the visual cortex and of the two streams, and now let's move to these areas that show specializations, okay? And I'm going to start with this reading of letters and numerical symbols in the left and right visual word form and visual number form area. This area were initially, as I said, reported by Laurent Cohen and Stanislas Isdahan. And basically what they try to argue is that letters and numbers are such a recent cultural invention that natural selection could not shape brain areas for this very purpose. However, since they are showing a very precise localization in the occipitotemporal cortex, in the ventral occipital cortex, what they suggested is that maybe what is happening here is how can have a selectivity that people that is reading in French here and across this entire hall, and someone in China in Hebrew from the right to left, all of them have quite a very nicely selectivity in relatively very consistent area. So what they suggested is there is some cultural, some cycling of brain activity. These brain areas, we know, they're actually part of the studies, show that they are foveal, so they respond more to the fovea, where we are using to read. So when we actually reading, we are jumping from in different places and read, only with, mainly with the fovea. And the second is that this area may be like line junctions, okay? So when we have a lot of line junctions in the different languages, so it was perfect to do this computation when now, when reading one is invented, the brain went, quote unquote, yeah, without consciousness, to the area that is most close to this invention, and recycle it now to do reading. And this is why we have such a nice selectivity. But when we discussed that, and I asked them, you know, we have Braille, which is used to read in a different sensory modality, so there is no issue of fovea and periphery. And also in Braille, there is no line junctions. It's all dots, and it's... So what do you think will happen? And they were actually really cool. They were very open to this question. And basically, the result we got was really very strong and very surprising. Just like previous studies, we found that there is activity in primary visual cortex, and there is a nice twist to the story, and that I will get back to it in the end, or maybe I would mention it now. But actually, the peak of the activation is falling exactly, you see here the peak of activation in the group of the congenitally blind, and this is the group results of the sighted, showing the most overlap and or the highest significance and less, and you see there is a very nice overlap in the peak, so they don't develop their own visual word form in the parietal cortex, and so on and so forth. So even if they never seen anything, and this text have nothing to do with light junctions or with foveal processing, it's still recruiting exactly the same areas. Now, what was even cooler is that we looked on the individual peaks of sighted reading by vision versus blind reading Braille versus nonsense Braille. So it's not an issue of the tactile input. The tactile input is the same. And actually, when we do, we don't contrast them, but we look in both of them, there is a very strong activity in the hand area in S1 and some other parietal areas. But when we look at the selectivity for reading, we get this activation. And you can see here that actually without tagging who was reading by, someone was reading by vision, somebody by touch, and so on and so forth, you cannot tell if this was sighted reading by vision and blind by touch. Now, this still don't tell us how can this selectivity develop in the tactile modality or in new modality. So what we did was the following experiment. Actually, when we started this experiment, we did not know anything about this selectivity in the right hemisphere for numbers. But we designed the following experiment, which have two components. One component was that we have a task, again, in which the sensory this time it's used the eye music, so this algorithm that I, so another sensory modality. The second thing is that this sensory modality is being learned in a much later age, okay? So this is learned not in the age of 6, but in the age of 30, 40, and so on and so forth. And basically, what the subject had to do, they got across the entire experiment the same stimuli, but each time, just like the shape location experiment, they needed to perform different tasks or different computation on this. And what you see here is that the example of three stimuli. So for example, we had in the numerical task, these symbols, they needed to report on the quantity, whether it's 5 or 10 or 1, okay? In the letter task, they have to say V, X, I, and so on and so forth. And in the color task, they need to ignore this and focus on the color and report the color of the shape, okay? And in addition to it, we also have a resting state, and now we are collecting also for the same task DTI results. But let's focus first on the selectivity issue. And what you see here very, very nicely is that we can replicate the result we found on Braille using a new sensory modality that was learned later in life. And on the other hand, we also found for the number task a very nice overlap with the number form area in the right side. Okay, so basically this is a replication and demonstrated the visual word form are reproducible across subjects, and that the occasion are not determined by feature of the stimuli in the visual modality. There he appears to be a metamodal in nature. And of course it makes some sense because, for example, if you think about this symbol, in one context this is represent a phoneme and in other contexts it represents the quantity. Now, the next thing we did was to look at resting state connectivity and look on a method which is called partial correlation, in which you take the seeds in one area and look and take out and remove the variance that is coming from the other area when subjects are doing nothing. Now, what is the rationale of this resting state network? I won't have time to explore here, but basically it was shown that you can track connectivity between areas to some extent and even plasticity. So for example, one of the first studies in resting state connectivity showed that if you are doing a scan of resting state, then the subjects would train the hand or the feet, and then you scan again, you can see changes in the resting state activity of this area, and also in the way that brain areas are coherent with each other at rest in low frequencies. And the bottom line of what we found when we did resting state on the sighted and on the congenitally blind is that actually, if you take the seed area in the visual waveform area, you can find increased connectivity in both the sighted and in the congenitally blind into the language system and the phonology system. On the other hand, when you go to the homolog in the right side, also in the left side to some extent, but much more in the right side, you find connectivity into quantity and numerosity areas that are being represented in the parietal cortex. So if to summarize this set of results, I will skip this. So this is basically the method. And later we showed that even you can actually reproduce retinotopy, for example, the center periphery organization, if you take the resting state of sighted without being showing them anything. You would still get all the connectivity between V1 and high order areas. But what is really cool in this brain study is that we show that even in the congenitally blind and even in micro-ophthalmic patients that never developed the retina, still the retinotopic foveal areas are connected to the rest of the foveal areas in the rest, V1, V2, V3, V4, and so on and so forth, even all the way to FFA, while the peripheral areas are connected to the rest of the peripheral areas. Now, just in a little twist, coming back to the Braille results, recently we showed, this is still unpublished, that if you go along the calcarine sulcus and look at the foveal part, the posterior part versus the anterior part, only in the left posterior part, the foveal parts, you get recruited by Braille. But the anterior part actually shows deactivation. So some type of center periphery organization like Schaubein locutetis, but now with reading Braille. And in the right side, you don't get any selectivity to Braille. So it seems that, if to summarize the set of studies, is that basically they suggest that the specialization is, the organization is task-specific sensory independent, and we suggest that they are being created, if not by this foveal tendency or by this line junction. Another take on this recycling theory would be to suggest that the selectivity is being driven by two factors that are, some of them are innate. One is that there is bias, the bias connectivity principle, which suggests that there is pre-existing cortical functional and anatomical connection linking occipital cortex various regions to the rest of the network processing this specific type of computation. Okay, so we are born with some pre-programmed connectivity that puts some constraints on the develop of selectivity when we are now never have visual experience, or we have a new sensory experience in the sight later in life, and so on and so forth. The second constraint suggests that different patches or different networks within the visual system show different sensitivity to task distinguishing features. So the intrinsic properties of the circuitry of the visual system may be tuned to extract specific but invariant task distinguishing feature of the object. So this together gives us the explanation of how come we develop selectivity for reading. Now I have 3 more minutes, so what I will just do is just give you a very, very quick... actually, just to finish this, maybe it's better to do one and then just to summarize the rest of the selectivities. But as I said in the beginning of the talk, in a series of studies, we actually went selectivity by selectivity and showed that these two principles and this selectivity can develop without visual experience and using this unique connectivity and distinguishing feature of each cortical area. I just want to give you one example. Maybe I would finish with this, if I have time, one more example from the body of some predictions that this theory has. So for example, the shape hypothesis predicts that expert Morse readers should not preferentially activate the visual Wortham area because in Morse you don't have any shape. It's only temporal analysis. And in this, and indeed this is the case. But recently what we did, we took the Morse code and we created a new symbol that is almost like code Morse, but have two features that are ventral stream in essence, a little bit of shape and a little bit of color to differentiate the colors. This you can hear here this language of Val language. So basically each symbol is very, very brief, and this is the slowest, so they can reach very fast speeds, and they can actually, after 10 hours of training, they can read a whole tweet in less than a minute, and they can learn much faster than Braille. And also all the people that drop in Braille can go and still do it, and also sighted. So in behaviorally, it's a very nice method. And what we showed in several studies, this is actually from a different study, but basically this is just summarizing a set of experiments, is one that when you add these additional features, when you have both color, which has come from timber, and shape, the ability to learn and to read is much, much faster. So when you have redundant information for each text, maybe it will tell us something about reading also. Maybe we can develop better systems also in vision, okay? Or multisensory system for reading, also for sighted. But I won't have time to show you all the data, but basically what we did in this study was to take a group of congenitally blind or microophthalmic, also sighted, teach them only half of the alphabet, and then scan their brain for Braille and for this new font, before they learn and after they learn. And what we show is that only the phonemes, and this happen in 2 hours interval, so they don't know anything. We take them out, we teach them 11 letters, we put them in scanner again. And what you see is that actually they develop selectivity to this new modality in the ages of 30, 40, even we have subjects at 60, in 2 hours, but only for the symbols that they know to do the transformation from symbol to phonology. Okay, so it's a very rapid, very dramatic selectivity that develops, but only to things that perform this task. Okay, so if you learn this cross-modal correspondence and can do it efficiently, you will develop it. I'm running out of time, so I will just show you. This is a object recognition in LO and by sounds. Maybe I would just, you can show causality. This is just anecdotal, but we can actually have them recognize an object, then zap their, this together was done, study together, sending the imaging result of this specific subject into Lotfi Merabet and Alvaro Pascual Leone. And basically, you do recognition of an object, then you do 10 minutes, 1 hertz TMS, to depress exactly the area that was activated by objects. And what you would get is their loose, so...
Atrophy. detected? Tape.
Yeah, and now she would go to the 10 minutes 1 hertz TMS.
No connector? No.
She come back and she explore it. I would save you the time, but she cannot even find the location of the objects. There is washout, and then she can do it again, okay? So the last 1 minute, and then I would summarize, is showing you the same for the visual exostride body area. What you see here is the mirror system found by Rizzolatti. It's a system that shows basically the same activity in the neuronal level for when you are performing a movement and when you are imitating the same movement. So it was suggested to play a very important role in learning, in imitating. So if I now open my cell phone, I press the home button, so my kid looked at me, and using the mirror system would do the same. And this is very well preserved in evolution, as I show you in a second. But what I want to emphasize is that most of the input to this system comes from this type of areas, like the visual exostride area. So it's mainly a visual input that we are using usually in our daily life to use the mirror system and imitate and learn and so on and so forth. So what happened in the congenitally blind when they don't have it? But just to show you that how it's well preserved, there is some images showing how well preserved this mirror system. You can see here this even kittens can do imitate the movement. Yeah, and it's so well preserved in evolution that even humans can do this type of mirror thing. I don't know if you noticed, but I'm a very serious scientist, so I went over the entire animal kingdom and found one example which is not working. But like any good scientist, I will just ignore this example. But what I want to show you is that now congenitally blind can learn to do the same thing. So this is again Hamutal, congenitally blind. She hears some soundscape, and now she would imitate it. Okay, and now we repeat it in the scanner with this and other categories, and the picture we get is very similar to what we get in the exostride body area, this time not in the visual Wolfram area, with the selectivity to the sounds without visual experience. So what? This is the last slide. The visual. So I try to summarize that the visual cortex principles of functional specialization and organization can develop without visual experience. It can also occur in normally developed brains to non-visual input in hours or 10 hours if the cross-modal correspondence are learned. And we suggest that this type of task-specific sensory-independent organization and plasticity is driven by a combination of connectivity biases innate and sensitivity to that distinctive feature of each area or network, okay? And maybe this was also combined with some ideas that Alvaro have of metamodal organization in which you have multisensory neurons in small quantities in each area that might be the driver for this. So this is all the papers and examples. You can download them. And I would just say that this also suggests that if this is their organization and this is their ability to perform plasticity so quickly, so maybe by combining this type of multisensory setup in which you will have visual stimulations with your prosthesis, some glove that will give you touch information and some sound, you can actually do the rehabilitation of prosthesis patients much quicker and much more efficiently, maybe coupled with some drugs that would enhance the experiences or the plasticity and so on and so forth. Okay, so thank you so much for your attention. And this is the last slide.